Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Henry Will, and welcome to another pmlessonslearned.com conference call. Today is July the 17th, 2008, and this is podcast number 41. We have a great speaker with us this evening. His name is Carl Pritchard. We'll be getting to his presentation in a minute on risk. But first, I just wanted to make a few announcements. First of all, for those on the call, please press star 6 to mute and unmute your phone. We're going to encourage a lot of participation today, but while Carl's speaking, we don't want any interruptions. So when he opens up the line, then feel free to push star 6 to unmute your phone and ask questions or make comments. I just wanted to mention, too, that pmlessonslearned.com is a large group now. We have more than 1,000 members around the globe. All people that are project managers who are here to help project managers, that's what we're all about. We have three subgroups now, the first one being the PMP exam prep study group, which is on the first Thursday every month. They have a conference call. Then we also have on the second Thursday every month our PM job shop, which is a career-based project management group that gets together, talks about project management careers, talks about project management job openings, and there's also a networking segment to that call. And then we've got this call on the third Thursday every month called our PM Lessons Learned PM Best Practices group. And we meet once a month on the third Thursday, as I said. So if you're interested in being part of our group, all you have to do to become a member is join our free Yahoo group. There's a link on our homepage at pmlessonslearned.com. That's about it for announcements. I wanted to introduce our speaker this evening. Carl Pritchard is someone that's probably familiar to many of you. Carl was the speaker on the recent project management cruise from the New Jersey chapter. We left out of New Jersey and went down to Bermuda and back. It was great. We had Carl Pritchard and two other speakers, and Carl spoke to us a lot about risk. Well, he's a PMP, and he's also an EVP, which, Carl, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that during your presentation here. He's the author of 5 project management texts, and he co-produced the landmark portable PMP prep, Conversations on Passing the PMP Exam. It's an audio series that he did with Leroy Ward. He's an internationally recognized lecturer, and he's an instructor. And he's the lead chapter author for the risk management chapter of the soon-to-be-released Guide to the PMBOK 4th edition. Already up to the 4th edition here, folks. That's going to be published by the Project Management Institute. He served as a PMI Project of the Year judge and is a U.S. correspondent for the British project magazine called Project Manager Today. Carl, thank you very much for being with us. We're looking forward to hearing you speak on the topic of risk management. Like you said, risk language and getting specific is our topic, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Well, thanks.
Go ahead.
I appreciate that, Henry. And in case at some point you're trying to get something through to me and I don't let you interrupt me because I have this nasty habit of trying to dominate a conversation, particularly when we're doing web-based podcasts, feel free to pop me an email as we go along. I'll be keeping my email box open and checking it from time to time. And if you have any questions or concerns, or if you're picking this up as a podcast after the fact and have some questions or concerns, please feel free to send them to me in an email. My email address is carl@carlpritchard.com. So, that said, I want to talk about risk and the whole language that goes with risk, because more and more, the problem with risk management is not, as much as it has been historically, process-driven. It's more a function just of the fact that people are still leery of having the whole risk conversation. The whole risk conversation, it's a tough conversation to have because there's two sides of this. There's a fear of asking the risk questions, and there's a fear of getting the risk answers. And that's because risk is, despite PMI's adherence to the notion that it is both opportunity and risk, it's still perceived as the bad things that could happen to us and the impacts they may cause. And as such, it's one of those things that gets really, really kind of, well, scary, because it's, you may be late. Yes, yes, you could be late. You could be over budget. You could be over budget. Oh, and you could die. And it always seems to end with that, and you could die, part. And that's what makes it really, well, frankly, an uncomfortable conversation to have, because nobody likes to talk about it. I was up in New York just yesterday, and as I was getting ready to close out class, we had been talking about risk management, and I said, what are some of the risks I face going home? And somebody goes, oh, your train could derail. I said, that's right, my train could derail, and what's the impact of that? And they said, well, you could die. And I said, that's right, and I could die. I said, my train could derail, and I could die. And I had one woman in the front of the room who just had that moment of, don't say that. And I was like, what's the problem? She said, you don't want to say that. Like it's self-fulfilling prophecy. Like somehow just evoking those words would somehow cause my Amtrak to derail on the way to D.C. By the way, I did make it home safely. That's why I'm talking to you this evening, which is actually a good thing. But the point being, you get into this situation, you get into this quandary where you're trying to ascertain what are the real risks on a project, and people not only don't like to have the conversation, they honestly don't know how to have the conversation. They're a little uncomfortable with the notion of how do you talk about risk. And that's the whole focus here this evening. We're going to be talking about risk language, getting specific, and trying to actually make the risk conversation a little less painful, a little easier to manage along the way. That's going to be my primary mission here this evening. And the way we're going to start that is I want to talk about how you've led any risk identification or risk assessment or risk qualification sessions that you may have had along the way. Oh, by the way, for any of you who are out there and want to mute your phones, Henry, what are the codes on that again? Is it star 6? I think it's star 6. Anyhow.
Yes, star 6 is the code to mute the phone, and then when you want to speak, you can press star 6 again.
Okay, thanks.
Does anybody want to jump in here and contribute to what Carl is asking?
Well, if not, don't worry. We'll get there. I have some a couple of provocative questions coming up, and I'll beat you up on those. But specifically, when it comes to the risk conversation, the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, what are we truly, genuinely worried about? And as you drive down the road some days, you'll be driving along, and you'll see an accident, and invariably we all have that nasty habit of doing what's called rubbernecking. We'll be driving along and we'll see an accident and we'll crane to look and see just how bad the damage was and just what might have happened and try and put the story together in our heads. And invariably, particularly if there's someone else, the two people in the car will then start sharing a story back and forth. Oh, the front bumper was dented. I'll bet it hit that post. I'll bet it hit. No, it must. I think it went off the guardrail. And they start concocting a story. And largely, that's what risk is, only we're doing it before the fact. Because risk identification is a preemptive kind of act. It's something we're trying to do before the fact. So for your big project, the biggest one you're working on right now, can any of you identify for me one big risk event you may have on your project? Just one risk event. I'll take anyone you want to toss out right now. And it's star 6 to unmute.
Sure.
Fire away. Who is this, by the way?
This is Arthur Hedge.
Hi, Arthur.
Hi. We're working on a large storage area network migration, and we have a specific technical expertise that we need involving Macintosh storage, planning, and that's a very difficult skill to get, and not confident that the person we have on the team is going to be able to meet all the needs, and yet we don't have a replacement. So that's a risk, that we won't be able to get the expertise we need to complete the project.
Oh, okay. Now, to Arthur's point, that is a lot of data. There's just a mountain of information, and that was wonderful, Arthur. I'm sitting here just misting up on you. But the beauty of what you just shared was the whole story that went behind it. It was, you know, not only are you're shy on skills, but not it's a tough skill to come by, and your person may not have all the talents required. The kicker is, what's the impact it may cause? What Arthur shared was the first half of a really magnificent risk event. He really did a wonderful job of describing the first half, the bad thing that may happen. We may not have the talent we require. The only component that's missing there is how bad the impact is. Is it just a function of, well, the project may be delayed? Is it a function of the project may be less than up to client par? Or is it so crucial, so critical that, well, if we don't have the right skills, people may be out of work, they don't keep their jobs, they all wind up starving on the streets, and we could die. And we wind up back there again. And the real crucial component of this in describing risk events is that most of us have this nasty habit of describing the bad thing that may happen without ever getting around to what's the impact that we're genuinely worried about. Or the flip side is often true as well. You'll sit in a meeting and you'll say, what are some of the risks? We might go over budget. Well, going over budget is an impact. The question is, what was the event that drove us to that magic moment? What was the bad thing that could happen? So if you want to improve the whole risk conversation in your organization, let me suggest to you there's one simple starter fix that is so easy to implement and doesn't require management intervention, doesn't even require approval of the PMO. The very simple fix, the very simple corrective action that we can take, and we can take almost immediately, you can start it tomorrow, is to simply have the templated phrase, what's the bad thing that may happen and the impact it may cause. So just simply putting the phraseology out there of bad thing, whatever it is, may happen, comma, causing impact, whatever the impact is. And just by putting those together, and in Arthur's scenario, it is we may not have the appropriate skills on the team, causing, and then it's the back half of that. And Arthur, if I can nudge you one more time and just pick on you, if I might, what is the impact? How bad could this get if you don't have the right skills on the team? What is the nightmare that you're kind of seeing in your dreams? And you have to star 6 to undo yourself again. Or maybe not. Yeah, he might have abandoned me for that matter. Either way, the key is to ask the question.
He's embarrassed.
I've abused him. Yeah, and I'm being punished for this. And I don't blame you, Arthur. I really don't. But the impact it may cause, it might be that the client would get upset. It might be, frankly, you know, one of the bad impacts that would be associated with this is the team member who thought they were really, really skilled in Mac might find out that, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not as good as I thought I was, and everyone now realizes that the project hinged on me and I didn't step up to the plate. Those kinds of things can be just as damaging and as damning as almost any other risks that we face in the project. We need to have the risk conversation because if we don't describe both the event and the impact it may cause, we miss a big half of the risk equation, and we miss the ability to genuinely assess probability as well. The whole risk qualification quantification thing stems from this, and it's a function of describing what are the odds you're going to be delayed on your flight is one thing. What are the odds your flight is going to go down in a fiery ball is a completely different question. Both of those are going to be causing delays, but they have completely different impacts. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, what is it that we're really genuinely worried about? What is the event? And what's the impact it may cause? We need both cause and effect out of this. And that's really what we really need to look at in the long haul on all of our risks, is how bad can things get and what does that actually mean to us? It was interesting. A friend of mine lives down in Times Beach, Mississippi. And for those of you who don't know where Times Beach, Mississippi is, it's right on the Gulf Coast. And he was there for Hurricane Katrina. And during Katrina, and by the way, just to put this in perspective, A, he's a project manager. B, he's a former Navy CB. And C, the guy is just as anal retentive as the rest of us project managers. And the interesting thing with Len was, I talked to him about it, and I said, how'd Katrina go? I've been trying to get a hold of you for some time. And he said, oh, we're fine. And I'm like, wow, I'm really surprised, because you are literally on the water. And he said, well, yeah, we lost some pecan trees and everything else. And I said, do you have power back yet? And he goes, oh, yeah, we had power that night. I said, you had power that night? I said, the way the report sounded, it didn't sound like anybody down on the coast was going to have power for weeks. And he goes, oh, I had a generator. I said, wow, how sweet. What a smart human you are. Yeah, it's a propane generator. And I said, well, that makes a lot of sense. And he said, yeah, it's a propane generator that I've been firing up every week for years now. Fired up once a week, let it run for an hour, put a draw down against it so that I was drawing some power out of it, making sure it worked once a week, every week. And you know, I was the only person in the neighborhood doing that. Everybody had generators. I'm the only one who had a generator that worked. And I took pause because for a lot of those people, the risk was we may be out of power and we won't be able to do our day-to-day functions. For Len, it was I may be out of power and I may have a generator that doesn't work, was the impact. And he was not willing to stomach that impact because he had the foresight to understand that that was one of the potential impacts. He was able to mitigate a risk that other people didn't even see. The whole point with risk language is we need to talk about both halves of cause and effect. And we need to have that because different people see different impacts. Different people see different causes. A team member might get ill, causing delays in the project. Well, team members getting ill. We can then ask intelligent questions about the first half of that. The cause. What might make them ill? Is it Salmonella? Is it Ebola? There's a big difference there, and it changes the probabilities entirely. For the impact, there may be delays in the project. Are we worried about a day or two? Are we worried about months on end? I live only two blocks from Fort Detrick in Maryland. For those of you who don't know what Fort Detrick is, it's where the U.S. government no longer does germ warfare research. They now do bioterror research, which is much, much safer. And living just that close, living just over the fence from Fort Detrick, it's always kind of compelling because we get interesting news articles in our local paper that you never see. And one of them back in 2000, I think it was 2002, there was a woman working on their Ebola vaccine program, and she accidentally stuck herself with an investigative needle. Now, think about that. You're working on the Ebola program, hemorrhagic fever, one of the nastiest, most virulent things on the planet. And you're a nurse working in that environment, and you accidentally stick yourself with an Ebola needle. That's a real, real nasty thing. Now, think about what's the bad thing that may happen and the impact it may cause. Well, I may stick myself with a needle, and I may actually get infected with Ebola and die. That's a very real concern. The concern, however, from the Fort's perspective was she may stick herself with an Ebola needle and accidentally infect a major metropolitan area. That's a much bigger and more serious concern. And that's why this poor woman and their risk mitigation strategy, because their strategy was not focused nearly as much on her as it was on the potential contagion across the region, that she was locked down in level 5 biocontainment, a place called the Slammer, for 21 days waiting to see if it incubated. Fortunately, she did not catch the disease, but she spent 21 days in a small gray room waiting to find out if she was going to die from hemorrhagic fever. That's not a real pretty time, as you can imagine, 3 weeks of that risk event. But it's notable in that because the Fort didn't just look at the risk of what is the risk of one of our team members dying, but what is the risk of contagion across the region, they took far more radical steps than you or I might have thought were reasonable or even appropriate. And frankly, I'm kind of glad they think that way. Schedule is not a risk. We may lose a team member. That's a weak risk. We may lose Gustav when aliens suck out what's left of his brain through a straw, causing a 3-week delay as we track down new consultants. That's a great risk event. That's one that's well-defined. That's one that actually captures the whole essence of the bad thing that may happen and the impact it may cause. And if you do nothing else, when you start capturing this stuff, start identifying risks in a real comprehensive fashion like that through a simple template of what's the bad thing and the impact. Oh, just a note on this, and this is really unrelated to the language piece of this so much, but it is still about communicating risk. And that is, where do you currently store your risk information? where are you tucking that risk information away? Where are you keeping it housed on your in your corporate environment? Well, and if you want to chime in, feel free. Go ahead and interrupt me. I'll hear you deep. I'll hear you punch the little buttons. But most people tell me, fire away. Where do you keep it?
Carl, this is Henry. We have a spreadsheet that we use for tracking risks, and that spreadsheet has what you just talked about. It has the percentage possibility of it occurring, or the probability of it occurring, and then the impact.
Well, that's great. That's the PMI gospel. You have a risk register, which is normally kept in some kind of spreadsheet format. For those of you who don't have such a register already established, let me suggest to you that one place to keep such a register, one place to keep such a spreadsheet, is not necessarily in Excel. Excel is probably the most common answer to that question. So, Henry, you're on a par with your peers. One neat place to store it, though, because PMI preaches the gospel of risks should be identified one work package at a time, one neat place to store it is in Microsoft Project, or in your project management software. MS Project and all the project management software have something in common. That thing they have in common is that you have the ability to use text fields and numbers fields. And amazingly, most people never touch those. They might use the notes field, and that's about as adventurous as they get. But there are 30 text fields and 30 numbers fields in MS Project. There are legions more in Primavera and Niku. And they're available to you simply to keep that kind of information, other ancillary information. And you can rename those text fields. And you could rename one of them, Risk Event. You could rename another one of them, Impact. And fire away. Somebody just chimed in, or maybe that was just Henry signing off. But interrupt me if you will. But storing them in the project management software does something wonderful. If you store them in the PM software, you have a great capability that a lot of people don't have. And that is, by storing them in the project management software, you have the ability to actually start doing some serious risk knowledge transfer. Because most people don't store their risk information concurrently with their project information. And as a result, at the end of a project, that information gets separated out. In trying to keep that information consistent, one of the things we should do is try to look at and try to examine, are we doing it consistently in terms of the way it's phrased? Are we doing it consistently in terms of where it's stored? And beyond that, are we doing it in a way that is consistent with the organization and its culture? Dave Hilson is one of my peers. I often refer to him as the British version of me. He runs a consulting practice in London called Risk Doctor, and I always refer to myself as the Risk Guy, so we're kind of on that wavelength, if you will. The interesting thing Dave has been doing of late is he's been spending a lot of time talking about and investigating risk culture, looking at the risk cultures of organizations. And the question is, what is your organization's risk culture? What's amazing is different people have different abilities to discuss risk culture. They really don't understand exactly even what you mean when you say risk culture. And it's a matter of, are you comfortable walking up to your manager and telling them what a risk is, telling them that a bad thing may happen? If you found out tomorrow that your project was going to overrun its budget by 17 to 18%, in that range, think about what that dollar value is for your big project, would you be comfortable walking into management and asking the big question? Or letting them know that, by the way, this may happen to us. Would you be comfortable walking into their office and letting them know that? It's not a rhetorical question. If you really would, I'd like to hear from you. Greetings. Who punched in? Somebody punched in. Hi.
Hello.
Who's this?
Can you hear me?
Your first name will do. That's who am I talking to?
Hi, this is Lorleen.
Hey, Lorleen, how are you?
I'm good.
That's wonderful.
I'm sorry, I muted. I muted the.
Well, no, you're there. And
was.
my question was real simple. Would you be comfortable walking into your management and saying we may be facing a 17% overrun?
only if I needed them to help me and I needed their clout.
Okay.
And this is with any risk. If there's, you know, if there's something that's shaky that I'm like leery about telling the customer, if I've got management backing behind me and management could go to a higher level than I can, yeah, I would want them in the, you know, in the boat with me.
How far would it have to go before you'd feel like you had to tell them? What percentage? Not a dollar value, just what percentage? Before you felt like, wow, they better know about this or I'm in deep, deep trouble.
At the moment when I would think that they can help me.
Okay, so
and it would be pretty early on.
Okay. And what's notable about that, and thanks, I appreciate that, Arlene. The what's notable about what you just said is it's an attitude that didn't exist, and of all places, Lockheed Martin. I don't know if any of you saw, and at the beginning of the conference call, Henry made the comment. He said, oh, Carl's an EVP, an Earned Value Professional. I'm certified by the Association for the Advancement of Cost Engineering International as an Earned Value Professional. And the reason I went after the EVP certification is because I live in the Washington area. And living and consulting in the Washington area, earned value is a very big deal because the Office of Management and Budget has dictated that a lot more projects need to have earned value than have had them in the past. So a lot of government agencies are looking for people with earned value expertise. And the other side of that is that Sarbanes-Oxley is also putting a lot of pressure on regular corporations to do due diligence on their projects. And as a result, a lot of those projects are now turning to earned value as proof of due diligence. Doesn't necessarily mean things went well, but at least they did due diligence to prove that they had a sense of when things were going wrong and out of control. And what Marlene just said was really important, because what she just said was she has a sense of when she's going to management. She has a sense of the risk culture and what will be tolerated in her organization and what won't. And we need to start getting to the point where we understand management tolerances. Oh, I started bringing up Lockheed Martin and tied that into this. Lockheed Martin on June 4th was written up on, not on just any page of the Washington Post. They made the front page of the Washington Post, and I never thought I'd see those four words on the front page of a major metropolitan newspaper, and it said, Earned Value Management System. And I almost freaked out. I just started laughing. It was like, wow, I am a prophet. What a great thing. Because I saw that, and I was in utter disbelief. Here I was looking at those magic words on the front page of the Washington Post, and what had happened was a government watchdog agency had found out that the Defense Contract Audit Agency was taking Lockheed to task for failing to do 19 of the 32 cost schedule control systems criteria that are required to implement earned value. What's notable about that and what ties into that is at some point when somebody wasn't doing one of the criteria, oh, somebody I'm sure said, oh, it's not that big a deal. You know, if they catch us, they'll slap us on the wrist and we'll move on. And when they missed two of the criteria, maybe they didn't have consistently sized work packages. They thought, oh, you know, well, it's a little thing. They'll let it slide. But someplace down the road between 0 and 19, you would think that somebody would have stopped and said, wow, you know, this is spinning somewhat dangerously out of control. And that's exactly the kind of thinking that needs to go in there before it happens. Otherwise, it's the old story of the boiling frog. A lot of us get the sense that we're boiled frogs. If you've never heard that old analogy, which, by the way, is a myth, that if you take a frog and you put it into hot water, it will immediately jump out. If you put it into cool water and heat the water ever so gradually, the frog will literally stay there until it's boiled. And the point being that in many cases we are boiled frogs. We allow things to happen so small, so incrementally, so slowly that we don't realize they're even happening to us. We need to have a common risk language for things like just what a risk event is, but also for things like tolerances. We need to know what we can not stand. What are the big risk events? I had a student from Sandia Lab. Some of you have heard of Sandia. They do nuclear work out in the Nevada desert. And at a student from Sandia Labs in my class, and I said, is there anything your organization simply always will not tolerate, and everybody knows they will not tolerate it? And the guy raised his hand, and I said, what is it? And he said, it's the BFL. And I said, I'm almost afraid to ask, but what is a BFL? And he said, the blinding flash of light. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm very glad that that's a no-no in your organization, that that's beyond the tolerance of your organization. He said, yeah, everybody knows from the day they walk in, you do absolutely nothing that in any way, shape, or form could ever possibly cause the blinding flash of light. And again, it was one of those, ah, what a great tolerance. What a beautiful thing to identify for people, to say up front, if you're thinking there's some way, even in the remotest possibility, that it could cause a BFL, that's a very big deal. On a much more microcosmic scale, one of my clients is one of the major construction firms in the world, and I was teaching a class in their environment, and sure enough, the morning I showed up, I went into this beautiful classroom, walked in, but the screen, as I punched the button to bring it down, wouldn't drop down. And it wasn't that far up, so I just grabbed myself a chair, and I was about to step up on the chair to unhook the screen, and one of the people in the room screamed like I had just pulled out a bomb. I said, what's the matter? And he said, you weren't going to stand on that chair, were you? I said, well, yeah. I said, just need to unhook the screen here. And he said, I've already called facilities. Don't do a thing. And I said, what's the problem? And he goes, safety. That is not safe. And I said, it's stepping on a chair. I do it. He goes, don't even tell me you do this at home. I don't even want to hear that. He said, he named the company, we don't do it here. And sure enough, every place I've ever gone within that company since that day, I've now realized that safety violations are something they will not tolerate. Every meeting opens with a safety minute. Every discussion they have has the word safety someplace embedded in it. And you might think, well, that's kind of overzealous. No, it's not, because they are passionate about it, and they make it clear to each and every employee what they will and will not tolerate. Would that we could all be that clear about our tolerances for risk. We're not very good about stating what they are. In fact, most of us learn them heuristically. Heuristics, for those of you who don't know what heuristics are, that's learning by discovery. We learn what the tolerances are by violating them, by getting slapped around by management when they tell us, you don't do that here. The pity in that is, and the crime in that, is that we lose sight of a lot of valuable information because people just worry that all risk is punitive. Indeed, the way this company was handling that safety issue of me stepping on a chair was indicative to me that they had gotten their message through to everybody. There wasn't a single soul in that organization who didn't understand the tolerances on risk. I had a meeting with a major Midwest foods manufacturer, and it was beautiful because when I suggested that I do some risk consulting with them, they said, well, the first meeting you're going to have is with our C-level people, CIO, CFO, CEO, CTO. And I was meeting with some their honchos, their top cheeses, their big dogs, and what was noteworthy was they wanted to set down their tolerances before we had any of the discussion with the lower echelons. And I was so impressed. Because organizations that take that kind of approach, that kind of mentality, they're the ones who are going to have the long-term victories when it comes to risk and risk language. But we can start it on a microcosmic level on our projects. And it starts with the simple question of what do you stand? $5,000. While we're sitting here on the phone, you get an email. And the email says, Marlon, or Arthur, if bad things happen between now and tomorrow morning, we might wind up losing another $5,000 on our project. Would that be a big deal? Just all you have to do is just punch in, holler yes or no, and then punch back out. But would that be a big deal to you? $5,000. I'll wait.
Star 6, folks, if you want to take your mute off. I would say no on my project.
Okay. That's one no.
Yes.
That's one yes. Well, we'll take those two. That's all I really needed was just to affirm that there are people on both ends of the fence. And one more? Nope. Okay. We've got a no and a yes. And it goes to the point, in some cultures, $5,000 is a very big deal. In other cultures, it's a rounding error. And what's staggering is we'll transfer people from one project to the next without realizing they were working on one of those big expensive projects, and we'll put them to work on one of these very, very tiny projects and not know that they don't know that now $5,000 actually matters to somebody. They don't realize that it's now a very big deal. And as a result, they don't have the insight that it takes to actually do the project right, to actually deal with it effectively, because they don't understand not only the conversation, but they don't understand where the tolerances are. Without the tolerances, they can't have, there's no way they can have the right risk language. They simply can't have it. It's not going to exist in their environment. We need tolerances. We also need thresholds. And the beauty is if you establish tolerances, you can then start talking about thresholds. There is a difference, by the way, and it's tested on the PMP exam, and it's also just a good point to have, and that is the difference between a tolerance and a threshold. A tolerance is the how far will your organization go before they will go no further, not another step. One company, one telecom that I used to work with, actually identified project-by-project tolerances at the chartering process of each and every project that they did. The way they did that was when they chartered a project, when they started a new project, what they did was there was a little box on the bottom of their forms, and it said kill criteria. When you charted a project, you had to identify what the termination criteria for that project were. Under what conditions would that project be sent up to management for review for termination? What an amazing prospect. Knowing before you start what it would take to kill it. Now, The beauty of that is if you know that you've got a project with $1 million tolerance, that's the absolute wall. If it gets to $1 million, it's going to be sent up to management for review for termination. You're only halfway through the project and you've spent $800,000. What are you going to do? Well, I'm thinking if you know that $1 million sends it up for review for termination, you're doing some serious explaining, backpedaling, and warning people, and you may even be talking to management and giving them a heads up that this may be headed their way sooner rather than later. The joy of that is that it takes the onus off us to try and mentally sift through what's management really thinking? When will they freak out on me? When are they actually going to have me hoisted out of here? And we'll know. We have concrete criteria for that kind of thing. We have those little warnings, and that's the wall, and we know we can't go beyond it. The thresholds I liken under the warning track in baseball. Some of you have actually been out on a baseball field. And when you've been out on a baseball field, if you've walked out to the very far reaches of the outfield, you have come to the wall. First time I took my sons to a baseball game was a Frederick Keys game. Frederick Keys, for those of you who don't know minor league baseball, they are the single A ball club for the Baltimore Orioles. They're the single A team. If you've never seen single A baseball, let me tell you, don't go to a major league game again until you see a minor league game. Go to single-A baseball because it's 3 innings of professional baseball and 6 innings of pure comedy. And I took my sons to a game when they were both very young, and we were sitting at the game, and we had that magic moment where this one guy just hammered one into the outfield, and this young player is streaking across the outfield, glove in the air, he's running for it, and there's that big wall just hanging out there, and he doesn't even see it coming. Bam! Runs into it. Boom! Crumples into a heap. My son looks over at me and he goes, "Dad, are those walls padded?" And I go, "No." And he goes, "Oh, why didn't the guy stop?" I took pause. I said, "Sonny, he didn't feel the warning track in his shoes." The warning track, for any of you who have been out in the outfield, you know, has a different feel from the turf that's in the outfield. It's either dirt or crumble or some other substance that actually has a different feel in your cleats or in your shoes than it does when you're running on just plain turf. There's a reason it has that different feel to it, and it's designed to actually warn baseball players to shield themselves before they whack into the wall and crumple into a heap. Project managers have a responsibility, if we know there's a tolerance of $1 million out there, to identify where the warning track is. When do you incurring costs so fast, so rapidly? When are you bumping into the schedule so hard and so fast? When are you violating what the customer wants so radically that it's time to stop the bus, let somebody know that, oh my gosh, we're about to hit a major wall. If we actually identify this stuff, if we verbalize it, if we document it, if we capture it, if we put it out for other people to see, we have the ability then to start doing something wonderful, and that is having a common lexicon, having a common dictionary, having a common ability to speak risk management. Now, tragically, when it comes to risk management, a lot of times what people wind up with is just vague notions. If it gets big, let me know. That's not a tolerance. That's not a threshold. That's not even really an effective warning. What that is a very simple statement that essentially doesn't say much of anything. What we really need are clear statements that actually dictate. If you consume more than 10% of our contingency, I need to know about that. Drag me out of a wedding or funeral. I need to know yesterday. There needs to be specific courses of action. People need to know who to tell, when to tell, and how much to tell, and what detail to come to the table armed with. And ideally, they should also be warned to come with solutions. One of the other challenges with risk management is that we have different linguistics when it comes to risk. What's an issue? What's a symptom? What's a trigger? What constitutes contingency? Those are all different terms and terminology that are associated with risk, and people throw them around like they mean something when no two people can often agree on what they are. We need to have a common understanding of what those terms are. The PMBOK has gone a long way towards accomplishing that. The risk standard from PMI, which for those of you who are listening to this live, let me just suggest to you, the risk standard is now in its comment phase. This is your one and only chance prior to its first publication to actually have influence over that document. And once it's published, I can tell you from having worked on PMBOK 4, once the document's published, making even minor changes is a daunting task. So if you want to really have a hand in the evolution of what the risk standards are for project management, now is the time to do it. You can actually influence the language of risk by participating in the whole risk standards process. The standard for risk closes out of its comment phase on the PMI.org website on August the 7th. So that's just around the corner. And for many of you who are listening on the podcast, that's probably already passed. But the key here is when it comes to linguistics, when it comes to language, if somebody says issue in a meeting and they actually mean risk, call them on it. A risk is a future phenomenon which has not yet occurred. A risk is still out there. It can still be prevented or at least mitigated prior to its occurrence. An issue is a risk whose time has come. An issue exists. Probability of issues is 100%. They're already with us. A symptom. Many people talk about symptoms and confuse them with early warning signs. Symptoms and triggers are closely related. Triggers are normally based on symptoms. If you ever heard all the warning signs of a heart attack, shortness of breath and so forth, those kinds of things are symptoms, and they may trigger you to dial 911. There are early warning signs for a heart attack as well, though, and we need to make sure we don't confuse early warning signs and symptoms. When you get your cholesterol numbers back and they come in at 213, it's not like you're suddenly going to dial 911, but it is time that we should trigger some specific actions. For the terms that go with risk, come up with your own language and your own linguistics. And if your organization or your PMO has not yet done it, you have the opportunity to become the risk maven of your organization simply by coming up with the language. The first place to start, the thresholds of pain. When will you scream on cost? When will you scream on schedule? When will you scream on customer concerns? What actions or conditions would exist politically to make you scream? If you can identify those kinds of things and identify them with crystal clarity so the team members know when it's time to avoid the problems, then you've actually made huge inroads on the language of risk. I have one more thing I want to talk about, which is risk alliances. But before I go there, it's kind of like the last bullet, if you will, in my presentation. I just want to take about 5 minutes for any questions that anybody came up with during the course of this. So let's take pause, if we might, and if you've been jotting any notes or if you have any concerns or if you're thinking, Carl, I was really hoping you'd get to this, now would be a good time to ask that question so that we can squeeze it in before the end of our time.
Yes, folks, this is Henry. You can press star 6 to unmute your phone if you have a question or a comment about what Carl talked about at this point.
Fire when ready.
Carl, while we're waiting.
Although there was somebody there, Henry.
Go ahead.
This is Rhoda Ondov. And I did join late, so I don't know whether you covered this already, but in talking about taking stock of where you are as far as early symptoms or triggers, it's common to take a look at things on a regular basis, say either on monthly status reports or at gates or something like that. How do you determine when to stay on top of things so that you don't wait too long before taking stock of where you are?
Well, and it's interesting. The risk standard actually talks to this, in that one of the things that it suggests that you do for each risk response you have, because what you're really talking about, Rhoda, are risk responses, and it's a matter of if you have set up triggers, if there is something that you want to watch, you want to have kind of a watchdog on, you actually assign somebody as the risk response owner. And frankly, this is one of those opportunities where a lot of times we have team members who don't have big roles in the project, team members who feel like, well, I'm just kind of secondary. I'm not really a big player in the whole thing. And it's a nice opportunity to say to them, hey, you know what I'd really like you to do? I want you to keep an eye on and to really harp on and focus on this one particular response. We've got it all set to go, but we're not going to jump on it until it actually needs to be implemented. But I want you to watch the triggers. And it's basically setting up that early warning system, as it were, and letting them then take ownership of it. If you don't want to do that, the other thing to do is to set up automatic triggers. One of the neat things you can do in some of the project management software, for example, most of them, including Microsoft Project, if you go to the Tools Options menu, you can change what constitutes critical for a critical path. The default setting is a critical path is float of 0. But if you want to be paranoid and you're thinking, boy, anything falls to 0, I'm dead, and you're thinking, I want to know when anything's within 7 days of the drop-dead date for this project, you can reset the amount of float that you're using and use that as the early warning system so that whenever you pull up the project file, if things are starting to pop up red, you know that you've had something slip to the point where you're less than a week away from going critical on your whole schedule.
Huh, I didn't know that.
I love things like that. But yeah, it's if you can set up the automatic visual triggers, that's really a beautiful thing because it makes it so that you feel smarter. You know, you don't feel like you're just hanging out there, and it's like having a nice big bank thermometer staring at you, telling you it's 90 degrees, it's 95 degrees, and you know when it hits 100, you're just going to boil over. You know that it's good to have that data. Does that answer your question?
Oh yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah, no, I just want to make sure. Any other questions before I hit my last big bullet?
Carl?
Yeah.
This is Judy.
Hi, Judy.
Risk identification, isn't that kind of like prevention rather than, you know, inspection and waiting for things to, you know, to pop up?
Amen.
I mean, most corporate environments, you know, reward firefighting rather than prevention. So to tell one team that it's okay to identify risks and then, on the other hand, back in the, you know, everyday job, then it's not so great, you know, when you keep saying, you know, be careful of this, be careful of that, watch this, watch that, and then you go back to your firefighting mode.
Yeah, and frankly, I think the one thing that if you're trying to get people out, you're trying to get people to step out of that paradigm
mm-hmm.
and get them to where they actually start rewarding and honoring the fire prevention experts.
Yep.
The best and most effective way to do that is when people firefight, when somebody, instead of lavishing them with accolades
exactly.
and high praise,
yep.
what should be doing is saying, you know, thank you very much for doing that. Now what I'd like you to do
mm-hmm.
is I'd like you to sit down with the people who are cleaning up your mess,
yep.
and I'd like you to explain to them how they can make sure this doesn't happen again in the future.
Absolutely.
And if they have to implement the same kind of rescue mission you did, how would they do precisely what you did?
Mm-hmm.
So that if nothing else, we're at least capturing the workarounds that they've done.
Right.
We're also getting a clear sense. And they then realize, oh, my gosh, I've got an obligation now to share this back into the organization. And frankly, for a lot of them, that's that's like, ooh, yuck. They they really don't like the notion. So, you know, and
because I've been around corporate people whereby there are certain people who are like early warning signals. Mm-hmm. You know, they keep giving that, and then they're branded as being negative.
Yeah, and amen. And I think the thing that when the first time somebody, you know, and I think they get branded even worse.
Mm-hmm.
The brand they get is, you know, I don't think you're being a team player.
Team player, right?
And it's like, what a pile. So I honestly think one of the best things, the pushback that they should be taught to give, is, if not now, when?
Yep.
When would you like me to let you know? I'm sorry to have bothered you with this. I'll make it a point in the future not to drag this to your doorstep. But so I know, when do you want this to happen? And if they say, you know, well, I only want to know when it really becomes a concern. Well, I'm saving it from being an expensive concern because, frankly, if an organization has more than three firefighters, one of them is an arsonist.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we really need to just basically have that conversation with management and say, what will you and won't you tolerate? And if they won't, we're never going to have alliances with them.
Yep, because management sometimes is creating that, you know, oftentimes it's a creator of that culture.
And it's not so much they need to be called on it, but they do need to be educated. It's a matter of, please tell me then, when do you want to know?
Because
if you don't want to know now, I need to know when should I be darkening your doorstep. And if I waited any longer, I felt like I would be remiss. So I would be giving you time to take good, effective management action.
Yep.
A lot of times, just asking that question, they'll be embarrassed because they'll realize what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We're almost, the clock is running down. I'll take a question if there's one out there, and then I'll hit my closing remarks here. Going once. Going twice. Okie doke. Last thing I want to talk about is just Coca-Cola. And an odd place to suddenly land in the middle of this conversation, but Coke. Coke is amazing in the level of consistency they bring to the table. If you've seen their new ad campaign for the Beijing Olympics, one of the things they've done is they've started issuing all these international cans. And you realize, even though you can't read what the can says, you know it's a can of Coke. There's no doubt in your mind it's a can of Coke, and it's going to taste exactly the same. It's going to be the exact same product. That's the real key with doing risk well, is making sure that people see you as that consistent. It's being able to brand yourself as one consistent risk manager. The more we can do to build in consistency and that Coke class consistency, which is never different, never wavering, and think about it. Coca-Cola never freaks out about anything. Coca-Cola, a friend of mine, Bonnie Duggan, used to work in Coca-Cola's crisis management team, and she said their whole job was to make sure that senior management never had to freak out. That was their job. It was going around and putting out all the little fires. It was going around making sure that fire prevention was done properly. It was going around and doing this, but they knew that it was time to spring into action, and that was early, early, early. You waste no time. Look back to the Tylenol scare. When we had the tainted Tylenol years and years ago, the company saved the Tylenol brand by virtue of being early and honest about everything that had happened. And that's the model we should be adopting when it comes to risk management. There should be no wavering. There should be no waffling. There should be no doubt about how we're going to approach risk. And then ultimately, even though it's often bad news, the beauty of it is if we're doing it consistently, everybody comes to know what to expect from us. And nobody hates that. Everybody likes consistency. There's something about consistency that really gives us comfort. We enjoy a degree of sameness. It's the reason you take certain roads home. It's the reason you watch certain TV shows. It's the reason you engage in certain behaviors. You may not be a great golfer, but you golf because you know what to expect. You have some idea of what's going to happen, and it may not be pretty. All that said, this is an hour. We don't have a whole boatload of time to share just mountains and mountains of information, but I'm a big believer in what Henry and the PM Lessons Learned people are doing, and because of that, I try to preach much the same gospel, which is knowledge is power, shared. We only get anywhere in this profession when we're actually willing to share information and do so freely. That said, my email address is carl@carlpritchard.com. You know, vanity, thy name is Carl. If you pop me an email about anything we discussed here tonight, I will always get back to you with an attempted intelligent answer within 24 hours. I always strive to respond within 24 hours. And that applies to the people who are dialing in on the podcast version as well, even after this is archived. So please, my email address is carl@carlpritchard.com, and I will try to respond, with the exception of November 2008. I'm taking a week off for my 25th anniversary, and I'll be shot if I take my laptop. But aside from that, I will always get back to you within 24 hours. That said, I sincerely appreciate your time and attention. It's tough being on your end, just sitting on the other end of a podcast like this, but I do appreciate all your time, energy, and effort. Thanks so much for being with us. Henry?
Thank you, Carl. I really appreciate it. And for those of you that are probably, some of you are hearing Carl for the first time, believe me, he really means what he says, and that's quite an offer, probably more so than I'm offering a free book to the first few people on the call or something along those lines like we've done before. Carl's offering you some real good advice that he's willing to help you out with your risk management. So please take advantage of that and email him at his email address. Like he said, carl@carlpritchard.com. And, of course, you can always get a hold of him through our website at pmlessonslearned.com. And this podcast will be archived on our website as well. And everything that we do within the PM Lessons Learned group is free because we're a group of project managers that are helping project managers. We're all volunteers. More than 1,000 of us now located around the globe. We've had people contacting us and telling us about how much PM Lessons Learned has meant to them and how much it's helped them in their project management careers. If you have a story to share with us about how PM Lessons Learned has helped you, please contact us using the email address share, S-H-A-R-E, at pmlessonslearned.com, because we're all about sharing our lessons learned with each other. Carl, I wanted to thank you very much for being with us this evening. Of course, as we usually do, when we stop the recording, we will continue to stay on the phone if anybody has any other follow-up questions on this or any other project management topic. I wanted to thank all of you for joining us on the phone and for those joining us in the future on the podcast. Please join our Yahoo group. It's a free group. You'll find the information on our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Please join our Yahoo group, and we'll send you information about future calls, as well as other project management information we have that will be helpful to your career. From time to time, we have authors that send us tips and hints for project managers, and we publish them to the Yahoo group list. So please take advantage of that. It's all free. I wanted to also mention that we have some great calls coming up, and please consult our schedule. If you look on our website, on the left-hand side, there's a link there for the schedule of future calls. And please feel free to take advantage of all of our past calls by clicking on the link for archives to past conference calls. That's all available free to you and free to all that want to take advantage of it. We hope that you'll participate in a future conference call or that you'll tune in through the podcast and just drop us a line through share at pmlessonslearned.com and let us know what PM Lessons Learned means to you. Thank you all for being with us this evening. Thank you, Carl, for sharing. We really appreciate you opening up this topic for us and describing some new, to me anyway, some new aspects of risk management. I appreciate hearing those. And actually, I have some questions for you after we get off the line here when I stop the recording. Maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the new things coming in the new PMBOK Edition 4 about risk management. I have some specific questions. Thank you again, everybody, for tuning in. And until next time, God bless you and keep on learning.
Please join us for a future conference call. We currently have several calls a month. Join our Yahoo group for more information about our calls and information to further your project management career. Membership is free. Details are at pmlessonslearned.com. We hope you'll continue to listen in to our podcasts and tell others about our podcasts and our group. PMLessonsLearned.com. We're all about project managers helping project managers. And until next time, keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.